From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, Minnesota Senator Al Franken and Arizona Representative Trent Frank's resignation announcements yesterday are the latest fallouts from the wave of sexual misconduct allegations being leveled against powerful men. In this hour, we ask a panel of feminists what they think this moment means and where it will lead. Will this recognition of widespread harassment usher in a more enlightened age? Or are we veering toward destructive backlash? Join us with your thoughts and questions after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, you're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. The wave of sexual harassment and assault allegations since the revelations about Harvey Weinstein and the Me Too movement are forcing a long overdue reckoning for sexual misconduct. And the list of ousted executives and politicians is growing. Last night, Arizona Representative Trent Franks announced he'd be resigning his seat at the end of next month for issues related to the inappropriate conversations he'd had about surrogacy with two female staffers. Minnesota Senator Al Franken announced his departure in a few weeks amid mounting pressure from the Democratic Party after an eighth woman came forward saying the senator had groped her. Let's hear some of Franken's statement yesterday.
Over the last few weeks, a number of women have come forward to talk about how they felt my actions had affected them. I was shocked. I was upset. But in responding to their claims, I also wanted to be respectful of that broader conversation, because all women deserve to be heard and their experiences taken seriously. I think that was the right thing to do. I also think it gave some people the false impression that I was admitting to doing things that, in fact, I haven't done. Some of the allegations against me are simply not true. Others I remember very differently.
For this hour of Forum, we've gathered a panel of feminist writers and thinkers to take stock of this moment and to look at where this flood of testimony from sexual assault and harassment victims could lead. Joining me are Lauren Duca. She's a columnist for Teen Vogue. Good morning, Lauren Duca.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Thanks for being here. We're also joined by Kate Harding. She's an author and editor. Her latest book is Nasty Women, Feminism, Resistance, and Revolution in Trump's America. She previously wrote the book Asking for It, The Alarming Rise of Rape Culture and What We Can Do About It. Good morning, Kate Harding.
Good morning, Mina.
And also with us is Karen Atiya. She is Global Opinions Editor for The Washington Post. Good morning, Karen Atiya.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being here. I'd like to start with you, if I could, Karen. What was your reaction to Al Franken's announcement that he was resigning from the Senate, and particularly that bit you just heard, where he was saying that he remembered these things very differently, but he felt that it was important for him to apologize and acknowledge, given the fact that this was a unique moment that could lead to better outcomes for women?
I think that's exactly the point, that we are in this unique new moment where we are very actively saying, you know, we are listening to women, we are hearing women, we are willing to take them seriously when they speak about abuse and about harassment. So in that sense, his words struck that tone that's in line with the moment that we are in. You know, and again, his impending resignation, it just speaks to just how pervasive this sort of culture of abuse and harassment is. Regardless, I mean, he did say whether or not everything is true, it's yet another example. No matter the political party, no matter the industry, we're seeing that treatment of women has been an issue, a serious problem for a long, long, long time. And Al Franken is just another example of that.
Kate Harding, you had written a piece where you had said that you did not want Al Franken to resign. I believe this was a little earlier when there may have been one allegation against him at the time. But how do you feel about his decision and announcement yesterday?
Sure. Well, I want to clarify that even in that piece that I said that because there was only one accuser at the time, I would change my mind if more accusers came forward. And as soon as one more did, and then one more did, I said, okay, of course, that's the end of the benefit of the doubt that I might have given him. Not that I doubted the first woman's story, especially when it came with that photo, which regardless of whatever else he may or may not have done, that photo was terrible and never should have happened and is so symptomatic of this culture that people do that for laughs and don't even think about the larger implications, and then later can go on and, you know, successfully run for the Senate without anything like that coming out or being seen as a mark against them until we end up in this very strange time.
Well, I think what I found interesting about your piece is that you were getting at degrees of harassment and sort of the hierarchy of harm that comes to women based on different types of allegations. And I feel like this has been a question that has been around this whole movement. As punishments or consequences are meted out, there's been this question of, okay, we've all agreed that sex harassment is unacceptable, but should we be treating the different forms of it equally? I wonder what you think, Lauren Duca.
Yeah, I think that there's definitely something with the way the facts are stacking up with Roy Moore and Al Franken, and he was very defiant in that speech.
He was.
I mean, I think he struck an interesting tone where he respected the movement, but there was certainly a feeling that he didn't think that he deserved to go down for this in the air, and a mourning over the fact that he is such a big casualty for the Democratic Party. But I think he became a necessary sacrifice, whereas we might have been able to have a more nuanced conversation about this and a fuller ethics investigation. And perhaps this the consequence would have been his resignation. But there was a need to move quickly because of the way this is falling into partisanship, and this conversation is having such a lack of accountability on the side of the GOP as compared to now how Democrats have handled it and Congress also resigned. And I think that we just sort of can't be spending the time parsing through in the same way we might be able to at a political level, because there has to be no compromises. And I think that the starting point has to be removing abusers from positions of power, perhaps in a more extreme and visible way than we'll need to be moving forward and then has been in the past, just really almost symbolically as a way of embracing this sea change. And people are going to be made into examples. And I do think that's what happened with Al Franken, but it was the right decision.
Do you think there is enough nuance in the discussion of degrees, Kate Harding?
I think it's so hard to have a nuanced discussion about any of this, because in many cases, something can be good and bad at the same time. It is good that the Democratic Party is beginning to hold abusers accountable, to believe women, to send the message that it is incredibly important to trust women who come forward and to enact consequences on the men who create this hostile environment for women in Congress and in our country when they are out in these public-facing leadership roles. But also, obviously, this is part of what I had argued in that op-ed, it's hard to lose, you know, Democratic seats in the Senate, where in Minnesota, he has a governor who's going to replace him with someone else who is a Democrat, so there's no net loss. But my question is, what happens when the next Democratic congressman is found out? Because I don't believe it's only Franken and Conyers. I don't, any more than I believe it's only the people that we know of on the GOP side, the Roy Moore, the Farenthold, the Donald Trumps out there. I would love to see all of them resign, and I would love to see the Democratic Party really take a look at itself and prepare for the reality that this is a when, not an if situation, that this is going to happen again. And can we be a little more proactive instead of just reacting every time some, you know, Republican oppo drop means another guy is accused and has to be drawn out of the party?
Well, one of the ways that some people have tried to talk about how these different allegations are different is to point out when they happened, right? So you had Orrin Hatch with Roy Moore saying, well, this happened decades ago, or, you know, the accusation against Dustin Hoffman when he's accused of harassing a 17-year-old production assistant in 1985, and he uses the, well, it was such a different time argument. Does that argument matter at all, Kate Harding?
You know,
Is that like where you think the conversation should be going when we talk about nuance?
I mean, when we're simply talking about the court of public opinion, like, I don't honestly care what happens to any of these men's reputation. Like, I'm not that concerned about it because that's not the bigger question here. The bigger question is, why have we been accepting variations on this same behavior for decades and decades? Were these things going to a court of law? Then certainly I would hope that's where you bring in nuance. That's where you bring in thin slicing. But at this point, I don't think when it happened matters nearly so much as the fact that it has been happening continuously with powerful men for decades, and this is the first time we are really nationally taking it seriously.
Well, let's hear a little bit more of Franken's announcement, and in particular this part.
I, of all people, am aware that there is some irony in the fact that I am leaving while a man who has bragged on tape about his history of sexual assault sits in the Oval Office, and a man who has repeatedly preyed on young girls campaigns for the Senate with the full support of his party. But this decision is not about me. It's about the people of Minnesota.
What that made me think about was how Franken acknowledges what we played earlier, that he apologized, but that his apology was misconstrued as an admission. We've also had men like Louis C.K., for example, who straight up said, the stories about me are true. Whereas you have, and he alludes to this, you have a president who is caught on tape, right? Admittedly bragging about groping women, and you have credible allegations against Roy Moore for essentially assaulting minors or molesting children. And so I guess the question that I have is what's your thought, Karen Atiyah, on what's happening to men who apologize versus men who are outright denying them?
Sure. I mean, it's a striking contrast. It sounds more like a variations on the theme of I'm sorry if I hurt someone rather than sometimes an outright sort of apology. One thing that does strike me about the contrast between, yes, you know, Al Franken, who has acknowledged it, at the very least acknowledged the hurt, versus, say, Trump, who has not, Roy Moore. One thing that is striking about this and about the support for Moore and Trump is every time this comes up, I go back to the exit polls from November 2016, and I go back to the demographics of who still chose to vote for Trump after those allegations or after the Access Hollywood tapes came out. And still, there was this sense that a man who was basically bragging about sexual assault, surely that this would be the turning point. This would be the ultimate backlash. But ultimately, 53% of white women still voted for Trump. And when we look at Roy Moore, even now, with kind of credible allegations that he was dating underage girls, a new Washington Post poll that just came out says that 6 in 10 white women in Alabama are still saying that they're going to vote for Moore. So I think there's also this, it reveals not only a divide in how these men are approaching their culpability in these acts, but also about who is continuing to stand behind and stand and support these men. And it falls along, you know, racial lines. So that is definitely a perplexing question, I think, for a lot of women of color like myself when we're looking at these cases.
And Lauren Duca, do you think the men who are denying it, you know, Karen Atiyah brings up the different ways that they are addressing whatever culpability. Do you think the men who are denying it outright are faring better than those who are apologizing or acknowledging it?
Definitely. I mean, I think we're having a huge problem with the function of shame, and that has been the issue with Donald Trump all along, and now it's clear that the same tactic is working for Roy Moore, and it does look like if you can just say, I didn't do this, that's your way out. I think that though we are having a big enough cultural shift where there are going to be more and more voices insisting on accountability as this moves forward, I think that we have had these conversations before, but the fundamental difference about Me Too versus, for example, I Believe Anita, is that previously we were rallying and having solidarity with the women, and now we are all the women. We're all putting ourselves forward in this way publicly, but I think in private conversations, that grassroots kind of spreading of conversation of first of all, women looking back and saying, it's not okay that I was treated that this way, and also then talking to their friends and their fathers and their brothers. And I mean, my dad is often a way that I measure how conversations are radiating outward. And obviously I'm invested in this in real time on Twitter every second of my life. But my dad emailed me the Charles Blow op-ed in the New York Times about how men can do better. And he had a quick little note of not realizing it was so bad. And I'm astonished by that because I've been telling him, and I think a lot of men have been told, but are also hearing the stories with the backing of a cultural movement. And that will lead to more and more people saying no, where hopefully just denying things outright is no longer accepted because we come to understand the pervasiveness of women being undermined and degraded at such an extreme degree in so many different settings. And learning to say no to that collectively as a society will take time. Hopefully Franken resigning and the Democrats drawing that hard line in the sand is a push towards progress where we're all able to say no in the same way.
Well, it's interesting, as we are learning more and more, and as men are learning more and more about what women have been experiencing, certain men have risen to the top in terms of the media, and maybe because of their high-profile status. I read an article where they were pointing out that no one seems to care about the allegations against Steven Seagal, right? But they care so much about the allegations against Louis C.K., and maybe that's just a function of their status. But Karen Attia, you've also pointed out how people don't seem to be paying as much attention to the accusations against musical artist R. Kelly. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I mean, I find it still stunning that as we're discussing sexual abuse and sexual harassment and exploitation of women, that R. Kelly hasn't come up in all of this. So with figures like Charlie Rose, with even Matt Lauer, one of the themes that rings true in all their cases and all their stories is that, oh, this was an open secret for such a long time in this industry. Well, when it comes to R. Kelly, the singer, I mean, it's been well over a decade, 15 years, that we've known about the cases of him preying on underage girls. We know about the allegations with him and marrying Aaliyah when she was just a teenager, allegedly, and Jim DeRogatis, who's been the writer who's been following R. Kelly for the greater part of a decade, has been consistently documenting this. And I just find the fact that his name is that not coming up in terms of our Me Too current moment, it's hard not to sense, is it, because the allegations are there. We have that history. I think the difference is, unfortunately, is that, you know, his accusers have largely been women of color, black women, black girls, not super famous necessarily. And I think part of that is, you know, the black community, wider community, we still continue to buy his music. We still continue to attend his shows. But yes, I feel a sense that if our society, mainstream society, again, took allegations or rather took seriously the safety and concerns of black women and girls as seriously as we did professional white collar, you know, largely white women, more wealthy white women, R. Kelly would be in this conversation.
Kate Harding, do you agree in terms of that there are quite a few women being left out of this conversation?
Absolutely. I think Karen's analysis of that is right on. And I would throw in that it took a long time, a much longer time for us to come to this point where we believed all of Cosby's accusers, just dozens of them, many of whom were black women. The only other factor, I do think that racism is the driving factor there. The only other thing I think is at play here is that we're seeing this strange thing where it's like the people that we already knew about are somehow skating by, where, you know, Dylan Farrow just had an op-ed saying, hi, what about my dad? I've told you all he molested me. We've been through this a bunch of times, but I feel like it's almost like there are so many new people in the news. Well, we can't revisit Woody Allen. We can't revisit Roman Polanski. We can't revisit R. Kelly because we have already, you know, had our cycle of outrage and done nothing. But I think with R. Kelly, especially since Dear Goddess has recently published on what he seems to still be doing in terms of abusing women and keeping adult women in this case, but women who it's very questionable whether they are fully consenting to be living with him right now or fully able to consent. And that's relatively new news that is still flying under the radar on R. Kelly despite this moment. And I think absolutely it is in large part because this country does not really care about Black women.
I want to invite our listeners to join the conversation. We're taking stock right now, first, of how this wave of sexual harassment and assault allegations is playing out in our culture. And we'll also be talking about where this moment could go. We're joined by Karen Atiyah, Global Opinions Editor for The Washington Post, Kate Harding, author and editor. Her book is Nasty Women, Feminism, Resistance, and Revolution in Trump's America. Her previous book is Asking for It, The Alarming Rise of Rape Culture. And we're also talking with Lauren Duca, who is a columnist for Teen Vogue and writes about these issues. Miriam writes, please discuss how the Me Too movement has systematically discounted the leadership of women of color and why Tarana Burke was not on the cover of Time. For feminism to be effective, it must be intersectional. White feminists need to elevate and center the leadership of women of color, and this is not happening in this movement at this time. And so she's underscoring what we were talking about. You can also share your comments on our website, kqed.org/forum. You can email us, forum@kqed.org. You can call us at 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. And you can also post your comments on Facebook and Twitter. Other points that have been made by folks like Barbara Ehrenreich and others is that, you know, we really need to be paying attention not just to what happens to white working class, white collar women, but also working class women, including hotel workers, you know, waitresses, people who are farm workers, and that therein lies some of that has been systematic for a long time, and observing what changes can be made in those workplaces could lead us to some solutions. Lauren Duca, I'm curious how, if you feel like you've noticed also generational differences in terms of how this moment is being interpreted.
I do. I think that there is a harder line that younger women are drawing, I think, because we're not having lived these things and having to revisit them with the same kind of distance. And there was a time when these things were more okay. And then the distance between allegations and incidents now is maybe part of the problem with how we're processing things. I think that there is something also very real in regard to R. Kelly's story being ignored. You know, how long it also took for Bill Cosby, where the person who's being accused is famous and in the public mind and possibly has been bringing you joy or whatever for however many years and is in your home connecting with you, with their music, with their acting.
And Lauren, I'll have to cut you off. This is Forum. Stay with us. You're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're talking about the wave of sexual harassment and assault allegations and how it's forcing a reckoning of sexual misconduct by the powerful, and also where this moment could potentially take us. We're joined by Karen Atiyah, Global Opinions Editor for The Washington Post. Also, Kate Harding. She is author and editor of Nasty Women, Feminism, Resistance, and Revolution. And we're also talking with Lauren Duca. She is a columnist for Teen Vogue. And we've invited your listeners to join the conversation with your thoughts about what you think, how you feel this movement is playing out. What are your concerns? What are your questions? And where you'd like to see this go? What kind of changes would you like to see? Tom writes, this all started with feminists and Democrats giving Bill Clinton a pass. They attacked his accusers. Does there need to be a reckoning around this, Lauren Duca, in terms of Bill Clinton and what he did? Would that be a healthy conversation right now?
I do think that Bill Clinton is something that we need to revisit. Certainly, this didn't all start with that. Sexual misconduct has a much longer history than Bill Clinton, but that was a very public incident that is in the past of progressives. And I think that because there was such a politically motivated attack on the Clintons from the right-wing media and by Ken Starr, it was easy to step up and defend him, and lost in the shuffle was the unacceptable nature of his behavior. But also the point that I was trying to make before the break was the weight of empathy with accusers versus the accused. And I think the reason why the Harvey Weinstein story is what broke through the noise and why things like what we saw with Bill Clinton perhaps didn't have the same impact is because Harvey Weinstein's accusers are all were many beloved famous women whose basically job is making us feel things about them on screen and who we feel like we know. And I think that the number of larger than life women that were coming forward about Harvey, perhaps if those were all low level interns at the Weinstein company, it wouldn't have had the same effect, even if the volume was similar. And I do think we're thinking about this with a new lenses and perspectives to see it, whereas often not really giving a crap about the women who it involved allowed these things to get swept up under the rug. So, in line with that, I do think with those new lenses and frameworks, we can look back and think critically about how there should have been harder lines on Bill Clinton and many other examples in our not too distant history.
Some of the concern about focusing on President Clinton has been that it'll take the focus off of our current president. Robert writes, any discussion of abuse and harassment of women by men, especially by political office holders, must mention the accusations against the president to put the discussion in the proper context. We've got a lot of calls coming in. I'd like to bring them into this conversation, and I'll start with Sarah in San Francisco. Hi, Sarah.
So should I just go ahead?
Yeah. What's on your mind?
So I have several concerns about this, particularly with the Al Franken resignation. But one of the main ones is that it seems like we're moving totally in the other direction, whereas before women were never believed. Now they are always believed, and I don't know that there's any inquiry into the accusations at all. And just as the right wing seems to always cry that this is a political thing, how do we know that this is not happening on the other side as well?
Well, that's an interesting point. Kate Harding, there have been, I think Sheryl Sandberg was quoted as saying that that there needs to be a process to ensure that people feel like due process is happening for those who are being accused of sexual harassment or even assault, and that if that sense doesn't exist, that we move too quickly to guilt, that will fuel the backlash against this movement. Do you agree?
Well, I think two things. One, I think backlash is inevitable. Backlash always follows progress. So I don't think we need to concern ourselves over much with whether we're fueling it or hastening it, because it's a foregone conclusion. So let's just talk about what we're dealing with right now. And I think due process is the wrong term and the wrong frame for what's happening here. Again, as I said, if we were bringing this into a court of law, that's where due process happens and where everyone deserves a full accounting with all of the nuance possible. But what we're talking about here really is employment and whether employers and colleagues find these accusations credible enough to say, I don't believe you belong in this position. And in that case, we don't need a trial. We don't need things proven beyond the reasonable doubt. We just need to say, are you someone that we want to continue working with us? And so far, the Democrats have said no about Franken and about Conyers, even if they said it very sadly in some cases. And I think if it comes out later that, you know, it's certainly not unheard of that there would be political setups, that there would be people brought out to lie just so that they can diminish women's credibility and take down a political opponent at the same time. If that comes out later, then, well, it's very sad that some men lost a job. What I found much sadder is all of the women who have lost opportunities because of the hostile environments, that this kind of behavior that we know is documented, that happens all the time, that is incredibly disgustingly common. So many women have not been able to rise in politics, have not been able to make their own movies, have not been able to achieve the levels of power and fame as some of these men have. Meanwhile, again, we have a president who has bragged about it, and we're not doing anything about the fact that 20 women have accused him of sexual assault. And at this point, because we know we're not doing anything about it, that only merited one paragraph in the Time cover story about this movement. So I think it is definitely premature and pretty much beside the point to worry that maybe we're putting too much stock in women's voices, because there are still so many we are already willfully ignoring.
Well, let me thank Sarah for the call and go to Greg in Redwood City. Hi, Greg.
Good morning. I just want to say, you know, I really wish the conversation would move to a broader conversation about workplace ethics and behaviors, because, you know, like my colleagues at work, you know, like a lot of the female employees are like light switches. As soon as they want something, you know, it's all flirtation and all on. And as soon as they want to be professional, then it's like, oh, please don't treat me like that. And it has to do with, like, well, you know, if it's a client, they're trying to get the sale, they're all in with flirtation. And then, you know, if it's something other. So it's just, I think that we should have, you know, a code of conduct in it, and that should be, you know, apply to everyone, regardless if it's, you know, a colleague or a, you know, client.
I guess I'm a little confused, Greg. So you're saying that you'd like the conversation to be about what exactly? About what the workplace should be like now? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, basically what the workplace ethics should be like. I mean, I feel like I'm the only person that know women that use themselves to get position or clients or whatever. And I don't understand, you know, why that's okay for a woman to use themselves to, you know, steal a deal or whatever, like, and be very flirtatious. I think it should be professional, and that if they want to be treated a certain way, then it should be all the time and not like a light switch. And I think, you know, I think it's horrible that people are put in this situation that they, you know, their financial well-being is, you know, in jeopardy if they don't do or something. But then when they're willing to do it, it just kind of feel like the conversation should move to a broader workplace ethic instead of just, you know, single incidents.
Well, Greg, let me get Karen Atiyah's response to your statement. Karen, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think the conversation we have is broadening this, and the sort of notion that women, you know, are using themselves to advance and to seal deals. I think what we've been seeing since the Harvey Weinstein moment is just how much men have been using their positions of power and using sometimes their physical bodies to create spaces and environments for women that were absolutely toxic. And one thing about this is about creating spaces where people can work and live to the best of their potential. And when men who are in positions of power, and frankly in a lot of the industries that we're talking about, media, Hollywood, politics, are male dominated, right? That is meaning that we are losing out on the talents, on the creativity, on the innovation that women have to provide to all of these sectors. And now I think the conversation is about not only the workplace, and not only creating this environment where everyone can perform to the best of the abilities, but now we're thinking about, you know, the rampant sexism in spaces like media. How has that affected our coverage? You know, Matt Lauer or NBC, we're looking at how is that culture of harassment and abuse and women and not taking women seriously, how did that affect how we looked at the presidential race last year? How did that affect Hillary Clinton coverage, right? So it's not just, we are broadening this conversation in the sense that we are finally listening to women and finally taking them seriously. But again, I'd reiterate the point that was made earlier. When it comes to businesses, this is also an economic issue. This is about women and people who have not been able to pursue jobs, women who've had to quit because they don't want to work with a harasser, women who'd had to take pay cuts because they don't want to work with a harasser, women who have been fired, right? This is we actually really need an economic toll about accounting for how much this has financially impacted not only women, but, you know, think about the losses of productivity that you deal with when you deal with toxic workplace environments. So, you know, I'd hope the caller would think a little more about that aspect when it comes to workplace environments and ethics going forward.
But also in terms of Lauren Duca, you know, flirting, this is a question of when people feel victimized. And, you know, the emphasis seems to be on the women's behavior as opposed to how it's being responded to.
Yeah, I also think there's something very odd. I've read now there's been a couple of New York Times kind of trend pieces where there are men grappling with what can we do now? And I find that really to be incredible. Like, there's this, can we have a holiday party? Can I give hugs? And I mean, the reality is I'm not really that worried about men spending a little extra time worrying about how they behave. I think that maybe it's about damn time that that was the case. And the discomfort perhaps is going to be shared a little bit. These are questions that are difficult to navigate. There are differing relationships. We're all human beings, and we can understand the complexities with which any one interaction is not like another, but we all need to be doing the work. And ultimately, it is as simple as treating each other like people. In the call that we just had, it seemed like there was an idea about women using their sexuality. Certainly women are capable of sexual harassment in the workplace, especially when they're in higher positions of power. This is not about women versus men. It's about the undercurrent of sexism in which it is so frequently women being degraded and undermined. But ultimately, I don't understand how there's this hand-wringing and concern about too many consequences or men having to worry about how they act around women, because clearly that's exactly the change that needs to happen.
Well, let's hear next from John in San Jose. Hi, John.
Hello. Thank you. Great show. So just real quick, I mean, I work at a publicly traded corporation. We have ethics training. We've had sexual harassment training. We have to take courses every couple years. And I find it very helpful. And, you know, when you're trained on this stuff, you know what's expected, what's not expected. You know, you can really, it really takes you a fair ways. And I think that, you know, everyone should get this type of training. But I think it's also very, you know, we need to be very kind of careful with where we're going here. And it just goes back to what your guest said a moment ago about hugging and men thinking about, you know, how they are being interpreted in their touching and what have you. And the opposite, the other bookend of this is, you know, the person who seems to have the right idea of all people is the person who most of us don't even agree with, Mike Pence, where he doesn't want to be touching anyone. He doesn't want to be involved in meetings with people. And at least at that point, you know, you can't be accused of anything. And I think what's happened with Al Franken is an absolute indication of this, where you can't even take a picture with somebody and be relatively warm to them without being accused of things like this. And I think that, you know, a lot of this has really been kind of pushed to the end. And Al Franken, you know, taking this hit is a, you know, zero tolerance. It's zero tolerance. But, you know, it really, I think, went a little bit step too far. Just,
well,
my opinion.
The conversation, John, wasn't that Al Franken was warm to women. It was that he groped. The accusation is that he groped women. But Kate Harding, what John is getting at is something that I've also read about, concerns that have been both written by men and women, that we're going to have some kind of sex panic in this country, that we're just going to become incredibly puritanical here. Kate Harding, what's your opinion of that?
I think, you know, this is uncharted territory, and I think certainly those things are possible, but we need to be smart and figure this out. Like, there's this thing that happens, and sociologists call it miscommunication theory, around rape and sexual assault and sexual harassment, that the way I would describe it is somehow you start talking about this stuff and men start acting like they have no clue about human behavior, like they have never been socialized, like they don't know the difference between a hug and like grabbing someone's breast. And so I feel like we have to hold them to account on that, where I acknowledge that like their fear is real, but the reason they feel vulnerable, even if they know they're not actually mistreating anyone, is because of all of these sexist frameworks we've set up, where you assume that women lie and women who can take down and ruin a man's career, ruin a man's life by telling a lie about him. Is that possible? Yes. Is it common? No. And we really need to recalibrate that fear of false accusations or of exaggerated accusations that can just suddenly spontaneously ruin a man's life. That's one thing. The other thing I really want to address that he said is that Mike Pence had the right idea. And it's interesting that the caller said that he doesn't want to be around people or anyone. No, Pence doesn't want to be around women alone. And this is the problem, is that I've seen a lot of guys, even liberal men, say, this is the idea, men and women just shouldn't be alone together. What that means is that then men are going to consolidate power even more. If you can't have a woman in a closed door meeting with another man, then how is she going to rise to the highest level in that company? If you can't have a dinner meeting with a woman or a lunch or a breakfast meeting with a woman without a chaperone, then how are you going to do business in the normal ways that we do business and give women a fair chance? All that is another way of excluding women from the room where it happens, as it were, which has been the problem all along.
I want to underscore your point, Kate, that false allegations are extremely rare. And if anything, sexual harassment and sexual assault is underreported. But I wonder, Karen Atiyah, once there is a false allegation, how do you think, if there one, just even one, do you think would do it in terms of suddenly suggesting that so many of these allegations are potentially false in our current climate environment?
Right. Yeah. I mean, the current climate, I mean, that's the fear, right? But I still think the emphasis is on the fact that the reason why there's such an outpouring now is that for so long, these acts have been underreported, not been reported. I mean, I think obviously there is this risk of false accusations, and there is a need for, you know, credible, just like, you know, we've talked about earlier in this conversation, credible and thin slicing through the, you know, through legal processes. I mean, I think workplace HR departments across the country should be reevaluating their processes for dealing with this. But again, you know, false accusations of rape, of harassment, are still very rare, but I think, again, the emphasis, I'm sort of less concerned with men's fears about this, and really, again, what's remarkable is about women's courage, finally, across the board, and talking about these and putting themselves out on the line. It takes a lot of bravery to hear some of these stories and for women to finally come forward and to talk about, you know, what's happened with them. And so if anything, I would think moving the conversation to recognizing the bravery of stepping forward and putting yourself on the line. Women, for a long time, we've faced a reputational backlash, financial backlash, professional backlash for speaking out. And I think the weight should go towards that and towards correcting this obvious problem, and instead of finger-wringing about the very, very, very small percentage of cases that could be false.
A listener writes, I am a woman who's worried about where all of this is heading. I read about a woman who said she was harassed by Franken when he grabbed her waist during a photo. Are we lumping actions like this all together now? It feels like a madness that has possessed this country. We cannot lump all of this together under the mantle of women's rights when there must be women who are lying and men who are telling the truth. What's next? Segregated workplaces. Marjorie writes, the failure to allow an ethics investigation to play itself out is a missed opportunity, since Al Franken professes to be an ally. The process might have helped clarify standards and provided an avenue for him to make amends in a way that sets an example for other men who have engaged in objectionable behaviors that prior generations found funny. And Aaron writes, what about trans women? Oftentimes our harassment ends up in death if our identities are found out. I find the omission puzzling. Again, trans women being left out of the conversation. We touched earlier on how women of color are being left out of this conversation, and certain, you know, professions are being left out of this conversation. Kate Harding, how do you think this will play out? I know you've given this some thought in terms of, you know, where you think this is going and what lies ahead for us.
Well, as I said earlier, the sad thing is I do think that it will end in backlash.
It will end in backlash, or that the backlash will be part of it?
That will be part of it. But that I don't – what's interesting to me is that the period before the backlash has already stretched so much longer than I ever imagined that it would. So I honestly don't know. You know, I really expected that this story, this movement would have been like pushed way down the front pages a long time ago. And it just keeps continuing with an energy and an anger in the best sense, in that is an energy and a motivating force that, it kind of does my heart good. I'm not honestly sure how it's going to play out, how it's going to burn out. I do know that there are going to be people, and you hear it, where you hear people calling in and saying, already, I'm worried, aren't we lumping too many things together? And it's true. Like, yes, I would really, if you said to me, choose who goes, only one of them, Trump or Franken, I would take Trump. If you said who goes, you know, Trump or a Republican who, you know, had done the things that Franken had done, I would clearly take Trump. Like, what he has said he's done, what he has said on camera he has done is extremely bad. So there are degrees, but I also don't think it's important to talk about the degrees any more than I think it's important to talk about, you know, what about the false accusations when we're trying to have a conversation about this real documented problem, this systemic problem that is going to be so difficult to dismantle, because all those things are distractions. And part of the reason that this has become so embedded in our institutions is because all anybody needs to do to end the conversation typically is bring up false accusations, bring up, you know, false equivalencies, and then suddenly it's, oh, well, we can't possibly talk about this real systemic problem and how to break it down anymore. So that's just all I want to talk about right now is how do we fix the problem, not the what if.
Yeah, so where should we be focusing, Lauren Duca?
I think part of this needs to be men coming forward and saying, no, not all men are like this. I think that that's a better use of any man who's listening, who is invested in this conversation. That's the best possible use, I think, of your energy is being vocal about the, you know, the idea that this is just how men are and left alone with a woman, this is how all men will behave is very insulting to men. I mean, I think it's this idea of being feral, of being unable to control yourself. I mean, that's all caught up in a boys will be boys mentality. The idea, you know, that those concepts paved the way for Donald Trump to cart off his admissions as quote unquote locker room talk. And part of the danger when we are talking about the backlash is the idea that we would just say this is how men are and we need some kind of sex panic Mike Pence response to it. I mean, I don't think this is how men are. I think that this is how a few bad men are and that we have created a culture of complicity that allows for it. And it is so pervasive because those bad actors have no structure of accountability. But women who have the strength to speak up need to do so for the women who can't or who are not being recognized and to support other women, especially trans women, especially women of color who have a much harder time being heard when they do come forward. But then also men need to step up and say, I am not this way and I'm not going to be this way and I'm not going to sit by while this kind of behavior happens. This is on all of us to make a change. It's certainly not a men versus women thing.
Well, Katrina Vandenhoevel, she wrote a piece about how the conversation now needs to move to laws that might change the behavior so that this, I guess, catharsis to some degree can change the conditions that allowed, as you described, this culture of complicity around sexual harassment and assault to arise in the first place. And she points to, for example, an ordinance in Chicago or a new law there that allows hotel workers to report immediately, you know, if they encounter somebody who exposed themselves with them or got handsy with them or things like that. You know, she suggests waitresses, you know, who have to put up with so much harassment so that they can get tips because their wages are so often tied to tips, right? If we could change that condition, that we'd be able to get at something more substantive in terms of changing the conditions that give harassment fuel. Karen Atiyah or any of you, do you have ideas along those lines?
Yeah, I think Karen absolutely. Atiyah. And I'm, yes. And I think those examples that you gave, and I think sometimes it's so embedded into our culture at all levels. I mean, thinking through even waitresses, right, who feel like they have to deal with abuse and harassment just to earn a living, really. Laws that can help protect these women and also that can help give a sense of what tangible real-world consequences could be for men or anybody in positions of power who decide to engage in this sort of behavior is absolutely necessary. I do think, as far as the question of where we go from here, what I do hope doesn't happen is that this moment is just we see maybe we go through a spell of we're seeing these high profile men who are leaving their jobs. And again, you know, rightly so. But that maybe 5, 6, 7 years down the line, men like this are able to come back and have a bit of a reemerge and enter into other positions of power. So I do think in order to consolidate this, absolutely, at the legal and policy level, when it comes to, you know, what are the regulations around, say, having slush funds in Congress to basically help settle these sort of claims, like in the Conyers situation, you know, how can those rules and regulations and laws be changed around around the money that's being used to pay off or settle these claims? So I definitely think that looking towards sort of the legal process will make it such that this is not just this raging social media anger, but rather a tangible moment where policy can be changed.
Well, I think that's a good place to end it. Karen Atiyah, Global Opinions Editor for The Washington Post, thanks for talking with us today. And Kate Harding, author and editor of Nasty Women, Feminism, Resistance, and Revolution, thanks also for joining us.
Thank you.
And Lauren Duca, a columnist for Teen Vogue, thanks for sharing your perspectives with us today.
Thank you.
This was our feminist panel breaking down what's happening with our sexual harassment reckoning and the Me Too revolution. Before we go, I'd like to recognize our longtime producer, Irene Noguchi, who is leaving Forum to become the executive producer of a new podcast at Vox Media, and to thank her for her relentless commitment to serving Forum's audience. Irene, you will be deeply missed. I'm Mina Kim. This is Forum. Thanks so much for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.